This is Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash, a podcast about everything that happens after Git Push. Ship It is brought to you by Fly.io, the home of changelog.com. Launch your apps close to your users all around the world. Learn how at fly.io.
What's up, friends? I'm here with a good friend of mine, Adam Jacob, co-founder and CEO of System Initiative. And I'm pretty excited to have him here because that means System Initiative is out there. It's GA. Adam, I heard that you launched something.
Yeah. Oh, I'm stoked. We did. Yeah, we launched something on the 25th of September. And yeah, you can use System Initiative now by going to a website and signing up. And three clicks and you're in. And then you can automate infrastructure. It's sick. It's the coolest thing in the universe. I'm so proud of it.
Well, let's level some folks up. Let's level up the Terraform folks, the Pulumi folks, the AWS CDK folks. As of System Initiative being GA, these folks are kind of doing things the old way, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hope is true.
Okay.
I think, yeah. Look, here's what it is. Basically, we figured out that part of the reason that it's so hard for us to achieve the outcomes we're looking to achieve with the kind of DevOps and operational work that we do is because the tools we're using sort of help bring about those tough outcomes. It's a lot harder to like write static code, have your friends review it. In System Initiative, what you do is you use this like living architecture diagram to put together all the different relationships between the things that you use. And then you can program that architecture diagram to do all the stuff you need it to do. So like it automatically understands how to do things like, you know, create resources and delete them or update their tags or do those things. But then you can also extend it with your own custom policy. And the whole thing happens in real time in multiplayer. Let's say you're gonna like build some infrastructure. You gotta go, you know, use an AWS account. You're gonna launch a new service. So you gotta go set up all the different pieces, the VPCs and the EKS clusters and, you know, ECS and database services. And you gotta set up IAM rules. There's all this stuff you gotta do. With System Initiative, what'll happen is you'll sign up, you'll get into this workspace, and then you'll have this list of all the different architecture assets that AWS provides. And what you'll do is throw those things into this big diagram in the center of the screen, which is basically this living architecture diagram. And then you'll connect them together, just like you would if you were drawing an architecture. And what it's doing when you do that is actually writing the code to describe how these things work. And it's running it as a simulation. So it's telling you in real time, this would work or this wouldn't. So you don't have to wait. There's no like long feedback loops. We can actually vet all of that infrastructure and all that architecture in advance. Then you can say, hey, this looks good. It's what I want to see in the real world. And you can apply that change set. And it's keeping track of all the different things you have to do to actually go make that infrastructure real. And then it goes and does it. And then after it does, it keeps track of those things too. So you can see both sides. You can see the real thing in the world that is what you created, and it's attached to the model of what you thought you wanted. And then you can use that to manage it over time. And then when you have customizations or tweaks or things you need to build for yourself, you can go write that directly into the system in real time in these same kind of change sets that you use to do the infrastructure. And so that's what it's like to use System Initiative. It's the most powerful, intuitive, collaborative way to do this work that's ever existed.
Okay, System Initiative is out there. It is GA and it's the future. Go to systeminit.com. Get started in three clicks. They do have a free tier that means free. No credit card required that you can play with. Again, systeminit.com. That's SYSTEMINIT.com.
Hello and welcome to Ship It, the podcast all about what happens after you get push. I'm your host, Justin Garrison, and with me as always is Autumn Nass. How's it going, Autumn?
Good.
Good. It's just, it's fall though. You got to be a little more excited than that, right?
I'm waiting for the coffee to kick in.
Well, you should have had it earlier. Well, it's like a skull cup. This is Halloween time now.
I got my kids some and I was like, we'll drink out of the skulls of our enemies. And I was like, don't tell that at school though. Like.
Well, I had my hot chocolate this morning after we had a conversation, our last week's conversation with Dave, talking about hot chocolate, and I got a free Starbucks for my birthday, so I went to we got a hot chocolate.
Happy birthday, Justin!
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And so Lily is on the show as a guest. Lily Chosik is a senior software engineer. And Lily, what software are you responsible for or have you been responsible for in the past?
Sure. So I recently joined like a month or so ago Influx Data. And right now I'm responsible for, or I'm learning to be responsible for, the cloud dedicated service. Essentially, it's the newest Influx DB version 3. So it's like a Columnar data store, and we run it in a managed single tenant cloud environment on Kubernetes and K3S. So it's a lot of different moving parts and from like the cloud native ecosystem. And funnily enough, it's like also we use a lot of things that I used to work on as well. So like Kubernetes, for example, is one of the projects that I used to work on while at Red Hat. So it's really nice, like Prometheus operator and the entire like monitoring stack. So it's really nice to like just go into a company and you already know things because you've run them before. So yeah, those are some of the things that I worked on.
One of the best things about open source is you can shift companies and be like, oh, you're doing the thing that I was already working on.
Exactly.
I'm very familiar with that. And I can keep contributing to the thing that's where it is. But you just had a whole bunch in that like initial, like what is Influx that I want to ask more questions about. Cause you said, A, it's single tenant. So if I go and I sign up for a hosted Influx database is like, I get my own instance of it. It's not multi-tenant. It's not sharing resources. You said it's on K3S. So you're, I'm assuming, creating not new cluster. Is it a new Kubernetes cluster per tenant or is this a new database per tenant?
It's both. So there's a serverless option for the V3 but this is like a dedicated one. So you don't have like noisy neighbors and you control the cost and essentially we run it for you. And it's like K3S, but we also use Kubernetes for the management nodes, for example. And then we run it on a cloud provider and we spin up instance of K3S per tenant that deploys like the database. And then it really depends like, because it's so like you can have different, if you have a larger query sizes, or if you write a lot more data, you can really configure and size up things. So that's like the neat part about the third version, definitely.
And the interesting part that you're doing this on top of a cloud provider, not using the cloud provider's managed solution for this, because you're carving up those VMs smaller with K3S. You're like, we can run a bunch of Kubernetes clusters here.
Yeah, obviously, like this is the entire architecture is Teams architecture. I just joined a month ago, and I think they did a really great job. Is it's extremely resilient, and what I really like about it is that I haven't used K3S before in the past, but like it's from the outside, I can't tell. That it's not Kubernetes, right. Obviously. Like we even run etcd within and not, I think it was like MySQL is the default or something.
SQLite,
that's the one, yes, thank you. But yeah, we I think they chose etcd, which was a really good choice, I think, as there's at least three nodes essentially always. It's like the minimum size, I think.
Yeah.
Again, I've been there a month, so.
Yeah, no problem.
If I make a mistake, it's on me.
The other thing I wanted to ask about is you described Influx as a columnar store database, and I always describe it as a time series database. Can you describe the difference and how, why you describe it that way versus another? Like when I think of columnar, I'm thinking of Cassandra. And when I'm thinking time series, I'm thinking of small single, like I've run Influx before in production and it was a great experience because it's like, this is the type of database that I would not have no problem managing because it is a simple management experience. But when I think of Cassandra, it's the opposite of that.
So I think this third version is different than the previous version. So there was like a version one, then there was a version two, and the third version, essentially it's built from scratch, from like the ground up, trying to maintain like a really high cardinality. So yeah, time series is definitely like an analogy that you can use there. And the cool part about it is that it uses like the Apache projects like Data Fusion and Parquet all together as building blocks into like this database.
I think I remember hearing or reading a podcast or a blog post about Influx switching from Go to Rust as part of that rewrite, right? So that was like part of the big, not only are we shifting architecture, but we're shifting language completely, which is a huge task for a company to say like, hey, we want to go this other route. And I'll find the blog post and put it in the show notes because it was interesting just seeing the benefits that Influx saw out of like, oh, we don't have garbage collection, which is one of those big things about Go, especially if you're running databases or things that might need to do this often. No shade to Java, of course. Which, sorry, Autumn, I had to do it.
You see, that's first he like rubbed in that his 3D printer is there, and now he's like in the Java, like rude.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting. So the majority, I would say, of the company uses Rust. We do use Rust as well in our team, but writing operators and controllers in Rust is still a bit rusty. Mm-hmm. No pun intended there. Sorry about that.
That was
like,
great.
You can do like a terrible graphic or something.
I was
like,
it was so good though. Yeah.
But we do use it for like CLI tools, and we have been trying to, like in the beginning, like the team was talking about how they did initially use Rust like as a client to Kubernetes, and they had some problems, and it's just easier because like what we use is KubeBuilder to like create the CRDs and create the logic there, and then the controller runtime, etc. And in Rust, you don't have that. You would have to like rewrite everything, and you just have to invest a lot more.
Yeah, and there's a lot less people that know it, but I definitely think that Rust is gaining really great traction.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing some Rust. I have like a small task in the next sprint, which is exciting. And I've been doing a tiny bit. I had to like troubleshoot at some point some containerd stuff and some containerd runtimes and like Nidus and stuff like that, the snapshotter. So like that's something wasn't working. And yeah, it got me really into Rust then. So that's been exciting.
Now, how is Influx different, or how's the work you were doing on the Prometheus operator in that stuff? Because like a lot of people will think of Prometheus as another sort of database time series store of being able to scrape metrics and do this stuff. Like, what is the difference there? How do you translating that work over to Influx, and why wouldn't someone use something like Prometheus?
I would say that Influx is a really generic or general purpose, I think is maybe the better term, database, and Prometheus is really, really like, it's only suited for the specific time series metrics format, as it comes like with the time series database already, TSDB already like baked in. Obviously you can like export the data into things like Thanos and other stuff. And definitely like a lot of people use still Influx for like long-term storage of metrics as well. There's a lot of customers that do that. And you can definitely like have the entire stack and you won't even notice. But I think that for me, like learning about Prometheus in the beginning, there's a lot of similarities. Like there's the write ahead log, there's like different terminologies that are really similar, and similar challenges, I would say, to running Prometheus. Like any database, I would say, even though a lot of people, it's controversial apparently to say that Prometheus is a database for some reason. I've heard people say, no, you have no experience in databases. Prometheus is not a database. But I still claim it is, because if you have to run Prometheus and you lose data, you have lost some. Anyway.
Could we maybe explain the use cases to each? Because I think a lot of, like, when I first got into NoSQL, a lot of people didn't know what, like, time series databases do. And it is a really cool, unique use case. So maybe like, I think it would benefit the audience by maybe explaining what those two things do and like when you would use them, I guess.
So with Prometheus specifically, you primarily use it for anything that you measure. So anything that needs to measure at a certain interval, and then whatever you do with that data, whether you visualize it, whether you alert on it, or you collect analytics, anything that can be, any endpoint that can be scraped. And there were a lot of use cases for this, like from everyone's alerting, like I think Kubernetes definitely like goes hand in hand with Prometheus and natively exposes like a lot of Prometheus metrics. So most like alerting systems or metric systems out there that are based, like that are on top of Kubernetes, use Prometheus for the alerting and rule evaluation or just metrics gathering. But in general, essentially whatever has a time notion for it to be able to like write the data and then also query the data is much quicker if you have a time-based series database, because it being able to not having like the notion of the columns and having just the notion of this is where I want to query from, because those are most likely your operations, right? Like I want to see in the past 2 hours what data I have gathered. And that's the kind of query you would then want to send versus like the general SQL queries of like top 10 last accessed or whatever you use SQL for.
If I remember correctly, they're immutable too, right?
Yes.
So that way that it can't be changed, because I think it sometimes is used in like certain production environments where they're used to audit too. So
yeah, that's an interesting use case. Yeah, definitely. Like with Prometheus, can do some stuff to delete the data, and there have been like use cases for that. Definitely customers who like don't fully maybe don't understand Prometheus, like we've had that at Red Hat, like demanded deletion, but because it saves the data in like chunks at the time, it was much harder to do those kind of things.
Yeah, because isn't that the whole point, is it for it to be immutable so that way you know all the data is there? That's interesting. Yeah. See, that's, I feel like a lot of times we try to explain like databases and people are like, I'm just going to use this, and you're like, well, is that really the right use case, like database for that? Because if you want to do that, it doesn't really fit that database offering, you know?
And I mean, sometimes going into it, we don't know what the data is going to look like or what the use case is going to be. And sometimes people just don't know that other databases exist for specific things, right?
Yes.
And that's the one of the hardest parts. Like my first experience with Influx was around 2017 or something. We had this database that was for licensing for software. So it was like, it would report, anytime people were using certain software, it would report it, it would add a row of like, I'm using the software at this time. And then every year we would load that up, query who used it in the last year and send it. But that was a SQL database, and it grew to over 4 terabytes in size of just everyone, whenever they launched software, like adding a row to it. And I was like, oh, this seems like time series data. Let me try to throw it in Influx. And I wrote a simple Python script that just sucked it all out. It took like 2 days to suck all the data in and throw it in Influx. And what used to take a couple days to query the data and give out a report from MySQL, is loading it and query all that stuff, because we had no indexes or anything. We were only doing it once a year for licensing, then turned into like, I think it was like, it was less than 4 gigs of data in Influx of just time series data of like, oh, I know everyone and I can query this instantly. And we can just throw away all that other data. And so we started reporting it from MySQL over to Influx. And I was like, this is just single binary. This is awesome. And then we could get dashboards on top of it and everything else. And so we were doing that. We started querying it, and I loved the like line protocol, because I literally was like testing this out with just like curl statements. I'm just like, oh, let me just like curl this string. This works really well. But then I discovered the tick stack, right? The full thing, the, what's it? Telegraph, Influx, yeah. Chronograph, and
Graphite, I believe. Yeah.
It's a capacitor.
Capacitor. Okay. See, my onboarding did not go well, clearly.
Yeah, well, these are old, right? Because like that's not what it does anymore.
I know. We went through it. Yeah.
I don't know what's in V3 of Influx, but I know for like V2, like some of that got integrated in directly in Influx. And so like the tick stack's not around anymore. But we like Telegraph was another one of those pieces where it's an agent that could report metrics out, and it was super easy to extend. We're just like, oh, add a bash script and make it executable in this folder, and we'll run it every time we run metrics. And so I caused an outage by doing that, because we deployed Telegraph and we're just like, oh, this is really great. We get this time series data from all the stuff. We didn't have a lot of that stuff back in the 20 teens. And I was calling a local command line tool to get stats about it, because it was a Puppet infrastructure. It ran manifest and everything, but I didn't realize that Puppet was backed by a MSSQL database. And so Telegraph was running on every node that we had every 5 minutes, but it was doing it on the minute. And so every minute, the database would get thousands of connections of every node running this bash script that would call another tool that then called the database. And so people started noticing at the command line, they're like, you know what? Like every once in a while, I get an error from my tool that I never used to get before. And it took us, you know, a couple of weeks where I'm like, oh, you know what? That was me.
It's crazy the amount of like damage you can do to a database by like connections, because you can take a whole database down, and like people never think of the fact that your connections can take your database down until it's too late.
And especially things that aren't consistent, yep. Right? It was just like, oh, like it wasn't until later we were like, you know what?
Because it's on intervals, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, we're like, this happens at a certain minute, and let's see what's going on. So we add skew to it. Like we just in Telegraph were like, oh yeah, add a 1 minute skew to these metrics and we're fine. Like we don't actually need it on the minute. And the problem went away. But like those are my first two, like, oh, I get the power of this thing as time series data, what it's supposed to do. We can get rid of some of those older style tools and kind of reduce the overhead and the maintenance and all that other stuff. Just for storing 4 terabytes of data.
I think once you get to a certain size for SQL, though, like you have to figure out something else, or you're going to have to get somebody who's really good at like architecting your data. But I mean, you're kind of sort of stuck at a certain point. But I think a lot of what influences databases too is the fact that some are more popular, and it's also like the education out there. Like MongoDB is so easy to like dump a bunch of data in.
Get started, yeah.
Yes, and they have such good like documentation, and it is just, it is very much made a way that it's like, you can just throw whatever you want in here, not have a DBA and get stuff out, you know?
What's up, friends? I'm here with Dave Rosenthal, CTO of Sentry. So Dave, when I look at Sentry, I see you driving towards full application health. Error monitoring, where things began, session replay, being able to replay a view of the interface a user had going on when they experienced an issue, with full tracing, full data, the advancements you're making with tracing and profiling, CRON monitoring, code coverage, user feedback, and just tons of integrations. Give me a glimpse into the inevitable future. What are you driving towards?
Yeah, one of the things that we're seeing is that in the past, people had separate systems where they had like logs on servers, written files. They were maybe sending some metrics to Datadog or something like that, or some other system. They were monitoring for errors with some product, maybe it was Sentry. But more and more what we see is people want all of these sources of telemetry logically tied together somehow. And that's really what we're pursuing at Sentry now. We have this concept of a trace ID, which is kind of a key that ties together all of the pieces of data that are associated with user action. So if a user loads a web page, we want to tie together all the server requests that happened, any errors that happened, any metrics that were collected. And what that allows on the back end, you don't just have to look at like three different graphs and sort of line them up in time and, you know, try to draw your own conclusions. You can actually like analyze and slice and dice the data and say, hey, what did this metric look like for people with this operating system versus this metric look like for people with this operating system, and actually get into those details. So this kind of idea of tying all of the telemetry data together using this concept of a trace ID or basically some key, I think is a big win for developers trying to diagnose and debug real world systems, and something that is, we're kind of charged the path for that for everybody.
Okay. Let's see you get there. Let's see you get there tomorrow.
Yeah.
Perfectly. How will systems be different? How will teams be different as a result?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, again, I'll just keep saying it maybe, but I think it kind of goes back to this debuggability experience. When you are digging into an issue, you know, having a sort of a richer data model that's, you know, your logs are structured, they're sort of this hierarchical structure with spans. And not only is it just the spans that are structured, they're tied to errors, they're tied to other things. So when you have the data model that's kind of interconnected, it opens up all different kinds of analysis that were just kind of either very manual before, kind of guessing that maybe this log was, you know, happened at the same time as this other thing, or were just impossible. We get excited not only about the new kinds of issues that we can detect with that interconnected data model, but also just for every issue that we do detect, how easy it is to get to the bottom of it.
I love it. Okay, so they mean it when they say code breaks, fix it faster with Sentry. More than 100,000 growing teams use Sentry to find problems fast, and you can too. Learn more at sentry.io. That's sentry.io. And use our code CHANGELOG. Get $100 off the team plan. That's almost 4 months free for you to try out Sentry. Once again, sentry.io.
You remember when Mongo was like exposed to the internet because the defaults was no password?
Oh, really?
Like people started getting ransomware in their Mongo database. Like people would like steal all the data and like leave one object in it. It's like, pay me this Bitcoin.
I don't know. I think that there are lots of great, like, I love open source and the fact that you can do all the things with the databases. And I love that there's, you know, you can choose between manage, but sometimes when you don't know what you're doing and you just want, just get a managed database.
As someone working on a managed database, I couldn't agree more.
You know, like sometimes it's worth paying stuff so you don't have to worry about it. And so that you can call and get someone to help you. Cause honestly, just the fact that you can call and ask people, like get the customer service with someone who's an expert to do your data like schemas and really talk about your access patterns can make a huge performance difference. Like, so it's not even just the managed side. It's the fact that you get that expert help and then you can support, teach your engineers. Yeah.
I did notice that there's a lot of like, in the recent, I would say years, there has been like a shift in databases where they're really specialized, like they're really focused.
They really are. And then it's funny because you're going for an interview and they're like, we want you to have 20 years of Postgres and I don't know, like Kafka experience. And I'm like, there are certain things that two people are not going to have 20 years of, but like, how old do you think I am? Like, and like, did I have two jobs at the same time? You're just like one's for like streaming data and one's is a SQL data. Yeah, and I'm just like, what are we? Yeah. Like, nobody has this. So it's like, it's wild. Like, I'm just like, I wonder if like recruiters and like jobs know what they're asking for. Like, have you ever touched these things?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Especially in this job market.
I know, like they're asking like for stuff that like, I swear, like they'll be like, we want you to have 20 years of experience in something that was made 2 years ago. And you're like, okay. It's wild. What did you do with Prometheus?
Yeah, I worked on, so I was at Red Hat and I was part of the OpenShift organization. And we essentially, OpenShift is the Red Hat Kubernetes offering that uses the components from Kubernetes, but like ships it itself, or like unpacks it and then packs it neatly into
corporate and open source. They have the weirdest babies.
Like, but it works really well. Like, it was definitely built by experts who work like on upstream Kubernetes still. And I was part of the cluster monitoring team, which essentially was in charge of the monitoring component, as every OpenShift came with monitoring. So out of the box, you had a Prometheus stack, you had metrics, you had alerts, you had runbooks. We even used like metrics for making decisions on how etcd should be run, on how like should we improve etcd, the decisions within the operators and controllers, as like OpenShift is basically like operators all the way down to etcd. So everything's managed by an operator or controller, whatever you prefer the wording.
Were you there before the CoreOS acquisition? Because like all the operator stuff was CoreOS, right? It's like, because my experience with OpenShift running it was back in the gears and cartridges days before Kubernetes. And I'm like, this isn't fun. And then they went into the Kubernetes phase and we're like, this is Red Hat software that's rough to run and rough to upgrade. And then they bought CoreOS and they brought all the Tectonic stuff that CoreOS did, all the operators, all that like automatic stuff. And I'm like, oh, now it's getting to the point where I'm interested. So, okay. But that was definitely the like OpenShift, like three phase.
Four.
Okay.
Yeah. Three was the, I think 3.something was still like, at some point they did a switch to operators. If I remember correctly, it was three or it was four. I don't know. I worked on four. I joined the week before Red Hat got sold to IBM. And I also worked at HashiCorp and same thing happened.
Acquisitions are following you.
So that was fun. But I worked closely actually with the CoreOS people before, as I worked at a small company called Kinfolk. They were like a Linux consultancy. They were bought by Microsoft. Yep. Yeah. Again, that's the thing. And I worked there on like some of their early operators. I was working with Chef on like the Habitat operator, which was like back in 2016 or something. So it was definitely like in the early days. So it was nice to like just watch what the CoreOS folks were doing. And essentially they invented a term, right? Like operators. I think not a lot of people still know that. I think people now just think operators or whatever is in Kubernetes, but they really like promoted that term.
And that's something that I think is really, like, CRDs were novel at the time, right? Like, this was something that, because this was coming off of third-party resources, we shifted from third-party resources to custom resource definitions, but people were still only building.
Nikita, right, was the one, I think, working on that with Dr. Stefan, if I remember correctly, back in the day.
But there was only controllers on the, like, core Kubernetes objects. Like, you were just doing pods and deployments and that sort of stuff, and they throw out this data, like, what if everything's a CRD? And you could do operators on all of them or controllers on all of them. We call that an operator. And some of that was like their examples were definitely data driven or more like, I want to say older software, but like software that needed a little more fine tuning to like control it and manage it. Databases, because I think like Cockroach came in, like CockroachDB was like an example of like, well, let's just write the database different, right? Like we can make the software different to run better at this sort of like distributed scale and not have to do this operator pattern. But people took the operator pattern and they went hog wild on it. They're just like,
I know, not everything has to be an operator, people.
Am I the only one who wonders why they named CockroachDB CockroachDB? Because I have so many questions.
That is, if I remember correctly, it's because it's like the last thing that dies or something. It's like indestructible.
Okay, that's actually pretty good marketing.
You want your database to always be available and always be up. And that was, yeah, it's always alive.
And if I remember correctly, Tiger Beetle, another database, did a similar naming team where it's also indestructible, or it's like
Tiger Beetle. Never heard that one.
Tiger Beetle? Is that Tiger Beetle?
Right. No, I'm waiting for like Dung Beetle, yeah, Tiger or Beetle, something, yeah. To okay.
Tiger Beetle, yeah, definitely. That's a good one. It's like a database, again, specialized in finance. So like they do just a very specialized database in finance, and they do it really well for a very specific use case, and it outperforms everything in transactions and to like just a regular SQL.
How did you get into this space? Like, you've been at a lot of these companies, and it seems like IBM's going to buy Influx at some point now. but like, you doing, you know, you were doing Red Hat, you were doing CoreOS, you were doing
Kinfolk,
yeah, that's, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With Flatcar, you were doing a lot of stuff in this space. How'd you get started here? What were you doing before?
I got into by accident. So I was at a Airbnb clone here based in Berlin. That was like one of my first jobs, like my first technical jobs. I did other jobs. And I was working in Berlin. And at the time, like there were a lot of like beginning to be a lot of like infrastructure meetups and things like that. So I went to like a random one. It was like a cloud native meetup before cloud native was a term. And that's where I like met the Kinfolk people actually. And they were like, we're hiring. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds cool. Because I was really interested into infrastructure because I worked like just on a regular backend Ruby on Rails thing. And while it was interesting, it didn't really like challenge me enough, or it didn't keep me interested. And I was really interested into like, we had a server that was running somewhere and everyone had SSH access and things like that. Like 10, 12, 15 years ago, whatever. It was a bit more normal. And I was like, that can't be right. And then I saw, like, I was at the infrastructure meetup. I was like, wow, that is definitely the future. So I really, like, got inspired, and I managed to get a job there. And then you had to do stuff. Like, we were a Linux consultancy, so had to figure things out as you went. So that was really nice. Like, I enjoy just being put into things, and then I'll dig myself out of it, essentially.
Sounds like you've had an amazing career. What's the favorite job that you've had out of all of these different places? Because you've worked at a lot of places.
I have to say my latest.
We can assume the current job, all right? Like, we'll put that one aside and say before this job, what was the one that you look back on?
Also, if a company wants to get acquired, they should hire you.
Well, it depends. Is that a thing people aim for? I don't know. Depends. So I think that there were two, I would say. Like, I definitely really enjoyed my time at Red Hat because I got to work on upstream things while also working on using the upstream project. So, like, I was a maintainer of, I don't know, like six projects at some point, which was like just because it was our entire stack and not a lot of people like were maintainers of that. But it was really nice because I still use those projects to this day and a lot of people still use it. So I was really lucky to like get into that stage. I also worked like on Operator SDK while I was at Red Hat, and I also briefly worked on etcd, which was really fun because I like, my passion is databases, and I really like, that's the thing that I really enjoy the most. But I think that I would say besides Red Hat, I really enjoyed like HashiCorp. It was really one of my favorite times because we got to build like a brand new service from scratch, like a cloud hosted.
That's so fun.
It's really nice, like greenfield work. It's probably the best when you still don't have customers. Sorry?
Was that the HashiCloud or was this before?
I worked on Cloud Boundary. So that was really like a...
The access service, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I joined when we had zero code on the cloud side. There was like a product, the Boundary product, and we were a two-person team. And yeah, we managed to get to like seven people or something at the end. And we shipped everything within like 6 or 9 months or something. So we went from zero code on the cloud side, and obviously with a lot of SDKs and libraries and helpers and patterns already established, but it was still cool too.
That's still an achievement though. Like,
yeah, that was really rewarding. It was really nice like to be able to design something like that.
I think more than anything, that also like, it's a testament to how well you are, how good you are as a software engineer, but also how good the company culture is to get out of your way and let you do stuff.
Exactly. You know, definitely.
The low process overhead. And
because sometimes it takes longer to get approved than, right. You know,
to just build things. Yes, definitely. Like, I think that I would say HashiCorp has such a variety of products. For a company that is that young, I think they've been around for what, 12 years, 13 years, I don't know, something like that. There's such a variety of different like developer focused products, which is so rare to get right. Like the user experience is really good. The products are used everywhere. And then, yeah, so I think that it's a testament to how like the management does things there.
Was the open source challenges at both, like if we're just looking at like Red Hat and HashiCorp, both of them are open source first companies, whether Hashi is open source licensed right now, whatever, like you're writing code in the open that people can see, but it feels like it's opposite to me in that Red Hat is taking and building general open source things and they're productizing them, and HashiCorp is creating products first that are open source. That's how it seems from the outside, but it seems like the maintenance overhead, the open source responsibility, like as a maintainer for six projects, if I think of that in the Red Hat sense, sounds like just a bunch of burnout because everyone's going to be asking me all sorts of questions that I'm
like. Yeah, definitely. Like it is a lot of like, and it was a shared responsibility. Like we had quite a lot of projects in that team because like the monitoring stack really needs a lot to be able to like fully function and to be able to get like the full experience of observing like a system, whether it's functioning or not. But it was really like, we also worked on the product. So it was like double-edged. It was a lot of like, definitely a lot of upstream, a lot of open source, a lot of like, do you getting consensus from people from different companies to agree on things. There's a lot of challenges.
People don't understand, again, back to the like getting process out of the way, right? Like taking something that is generically open source and integrating that back into a project is really difficult. Because even just like the KET process in Kubernetes and all that stuff, you're like, I need to go tell five different companies that are invested in this thing that we need this feature and how it's going to benefit them versus the HashiCorp model, which is like, ain't no one else, like as an integrator, you're using the tools. You're not like building on top of it. Like people do build on top of console, but not like they build on top of etcd.
I don't think people talk about the politics of open source and a corporation and trying to get projects approved while you're balancing a business's stakeholders and open source maintainers is very complicated.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's really hard to also like manage the people who like want to do, like everyone gets paid by a company, right? Like at the end of the day, it is all business, right? Like while you are trying to put your open source project first, like, and you're trying to advocate for that within your company and say, this feature doesn't make any sense from that open source projects. Like you balance a lot of hats essentially, right? And you try to say, this doesn't make any sense. Like, sorry, let's try to think of a different way. But if it does make sense, then you have to go and convince other people that it makes sense and that we should have this. And yeah, it's a lot, yeah.
The amount of like, cause you need to think about what your customers need, right? But then that gets lost in the, what do the maintainers want to agree to and what do the corporations want to agree in investing in? So it's wild.
What's up, friends? I'm here in the breaks with my good friend, my new friend, Kyle Spearin, the creator of Bitwarden, the open source password manager you know and love. And now they have secrets management for businesses, for developers, for you, for your infrastructure, for all the things. So Kyle, I know that Bitwarden has deep roots. Take me to the beginning. How did you begin this thing?
The early stages of Bitwarden came from me wanting to create something that was really easy to use so that lots of people could adopt it and use it, but also appeal to people who are like-minded like myself, who really like the open source message and the benefits of open source technology and what that brings to the market. You know, fast forward several years of kind of doing that, there was a lot of untapped potential too in the product, but there's a lot of things I don't, you know, have strengths in and where I thought I could bring in outside help to help me. And I helped develop that over the course of several years of running the product and build those right relationships with the right people. And then once I was ready to kind of accept that help, I brought people in and we really took the business to the next level of where it could be. And now we have, you know, millions and millions and millions of users using our product today. And we have multiple products that we really service the kind of security industry with.
Okay, so now you've scaled, you've got millions and millions and millions of users deep into password management, and you've scaled the team, you've scaled the product, you've scaled the company, and now you have secrets management for teams, for infrastructure, for all the things. What are some of the key concerns that made you go this direction?
There's a sprawl of secrets for, you know, think about how large your environment is and all the things and all the endpoints and machines you have to manage to kind of orchestrate and make this whole thing work, right? Like there are tools that help you do all that, but all those tools are using secrets in different ways, right? You end up with this sprawl of secrets that are everywhere, much like the sprawl of secrets you have in password management of all the services you use on the internet. You know, it's kind of overwhelming. Like I think a lot of people, if you would ask how many different passwords or secrets that you have that you kind of use across the internet, if I had to bet, almost all of them would underestimate the value that they actually are. And once you understand the depth of the sprawl you have, it's a challenge to figure out how you're going to do that and what tool you're going to find to kind of manage that. In addition to the sprawl, there's also the sprawl of your organization itself, the human element of it as well, which, you know, at every company, there are people who come and there are people who go, and there are people who need access to certain secrets and there are people who don't need access to other secrets. And that's also a very challenging problem to solve. Part of the core feature set of what Bitwarden Secrets Manager is solving are those two problems. How do you manage from a single pane of glass all the secrets you need to use throughout your environments and infrastructure? And then how do you control who has access to those secrets in a kind of least privilege access way that creates the best security practices that you need to secure your organization?
Okay, get streamlined secrets management for developers at bitwarden.com/secrets. Get end-to-end encrypted Bitwarden Secrets Manager. Secure your infrastructure, your machine secrets, and your developer secrets. Start a free 7-day Bitwarden Secrets Manager trial today at bitwarden.com/secrets. That's bitwarden.com/secrets.
It's cool that you've worked in databases and infrastructure. Those are both my interests. How do you do that without getting burned out? Because those are very like key to business things, right? Like those are like some of the worst pager.
Because if
your infrastructure goes down, it's not good. If you can't get to your database, like those are two things that you are.
Getting paid for a database is the scariest page you can get. Like, I don't know of another, like website down. Okay. We can figure this one out. Like I know where to start. Like database down, like, I might have to drive somewhere.
Like we accidentally dropped a table or like, you know. Like,
delete the disk. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just like, so like, how have you managed to like grow and work and learn in those spaces and still maintain like not being super burnt out? And like, how did like, just, I feel like those are hard spaces to get into. So like for other people that want to get into it or grow their career, like, do you have any advice?
I always just try it. Like I try not to think too hard about it beforehand, because if you do, that's where you like, I think, lose the momentum essentially. But definitely I am going on call very soon. Apparently I'm ready to go on call. At least as a shadow.
1 month. Wow. That's a quick,
I mean, did you hear her career? She could probably fix anything. Sure. Okay.
Like, not anything though. No. Definitely.
I have faith in you. Like I just listened to you talk about your career and I'm just, wow. The whole time. Like,
but I think that the key is to just try things, right? Like it's easy to say, like there's no like magical solution or anything, right? Like it's just, you give it a try, and if it doesn't work, you try something else. And then at some point you figure it out, right? And trying to learn not so much like downwards the stack, but just like get a overall picture and then develop like the experience and the expertise when you actually need it.
Figuring out where the pieces fit together is a very hard thing to read marketing docs and get the understanding of. Right? Like you have to build some things to say, oh, this is why this fits here or why it doesn't fit here. And I'm going to like, you could shape just about anything to fit together, whether they should or not. So that's a really good thing. But I also think what you said there about trying something different, because a lot of times people look at that career of like, wow, you did so much successful stuff. And we didn't talk about anything that like you picked up for a week or 2 weeks and you're like, I don't want to do that anymore, or it doesn't fit. And it's okay to get rid of those things. And people forget that constantly while you're trying new things, you're also not continuing doing everything. you have to be able to shed some of that stuff.
Trying new things is scary. And I think a lot of times there's some kind of, I think there's a balance, right? Like it is good to use reliable things that, you know, but also like, especially in this market in these weird times, like I think people are going to have to try more new things and try things outside of their comfort
zone. The pressure is different, right? Yeah. Like the pressure today in 2024 is way different than it was even 10 years ago. When if you were trying something 10 years ago, there wasn't nonstop hustle bros saying you have to, you know, turn this into like your...
If somebody else says on like on Twitter about how we're all supposed to work the weekends and like, why aren't you building five projects? I'm like, I know we all own six domains.
Multiple streams of income, like, yes. All that stuff. Like, no, like you...
Are we ever supposed to enjoy our life? No, like...
Oh, yeah, no, I definitely do. I'm not one of those people who tends to build things on the weekend. I try to avoid that as much as I can. I'm not a classical, like, build things over the weekend. I work really hard during the week and focus, you know.
Yeah, every now and then, if it's something really cool that I want to build for me and my friends or just something, like, maybe, or, like, building something for my kids, but, like... That's not sustainable. Like, let's stop telling younger people or people that are new to the industry that that is sustainable, because it's not. That's how you burn out.
Especially in open source, where mm-hmm. there is no weekend in open source, right? If you don't have boundaries, it's not going to be set for you.
Well, even infrastructure and databases too, like you are a system administrator. Like if you get paged, you get paged. Like if the system goes down, like they don't care if it's Saturday.
Many companies will have a cycle of like, I'm on call this week, right? Like I need to be more available this week. The other 3 weeks I'm fine, or I can do that relaxed. But like you have to plan around that. Like, you know, I definitely had moments are like, I can't do vacation because I'm on call that week,
yep.
sort of thing. But like at the end of the day, like at a company, I'm like, oh, you're paying me for this amount of work and I'm going to give you that amount of work and I'm going to invest the time in it. But open source is like, ain't no one paying you for that. And they're just asking as many questions as they want and telling you like, I want to fit this thing over here with this other thing that I already understand. I'm like, no, don't stop. Like,
well, it's getting even more complicated because a lot of the open source projects that are going to be able to weather the storm are going to be funded by corporations, right? So not only are they getting paid, but now you've got different interests, you've got different, you know what I mean? Like different, it depends on the size of the company. So it's going to, I don't know, it's getting weird.
But also open source, I feel like it's shifting into an odd direction where
it's so weird. Everything's gotten
the licensing and everything is like shifting into a very interesting direction, which I understand, like from a business point of view, I completely get why you don't want to necessarily, like, you put a lot of effort into a company, especially if it's like your project that you started and you want to have it in the open for like companies and developers to use, right? But obviously you're a business and you want to sustain the business and pay your engineers and everything. And you don't necessarily want that license to be so permissive that someone else, like a larger corporation, can come along and just like take that project and then monetize off of it without investing. I think Kubernetes and like these really large projects work only because there's so many companies involved and so many large companies involved that there's not really like one company we associated with, even if like Google was the one who initially did majority of the work, but still.
A lot of successful open source is either completely monetized, owned by a single company. They drive direction, which is great. They could do a lot of stuff. The Hashi stack is one of those examples. Cockroach is another. The other side of it is foundations. And it's like, oh, the other, like we have to have this neutral ground that has some legal ownership over how this exists. And that's why companies like Google and Red Hat and Amazon and Microsoft can work together in the same code base, because they're like, hey, we know we're not giving money to one individual company, but we're going through that longer process to say, we need this feature. We need to now have someone that owns that feature inside the code base. They work in the foundation. They work politically to make sure it's backed, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of other things you have to consider.
I think before the CNFC and like the Linux Foundation were big, you know, now when these open source projects that people are betting on, like for instance, REST are like being born and they're starting foundations, you can tell that Rust was like very intentionally, like their foundation was started. A lot of their documentation, like it's changing the way we start big open source projects too, like even before, you know. So it's like, I wonder, like just the way that their foundation was put together and the way that companies want it to get on those foundations and the way that it was built is just really interesting, because that's all influenced by seeing how big like the Linux Foundation and CNFC and like all those things have gotten, you know. So it's like interesting if the way that we build these things are going to change, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, the last 10 years have had a lot of influx in various ways. And if I look at, I just watched the Node.js documentary on YouTube. I'm not a Node developer, but fascinating politics on how they weren't adapting Node to solve some use cases that many large corporations needed. And so they literally forked Node.js. And they're like, no, you need to, if you're not going to put this in a neutral foundation, we're not coming back. Basically, and they did the open source thing, the thing that open source should be able to do under an actual open source license and all that stuff. Like, they can fork it, they can own it, but then as soon as it had to come back, it's just like, oh, now we have a foundation that owns it neutrally, and there's multiple people that. But also, a lot of it is pay to play, and that makes me, a lot of it is just like, oh, like CNCF, if you're on the board, like, you paid to get there. Right, like, this is, you're paying millions of dollars into this foundation supporting this as like a, we need this open source to exist, but like, as a startup, like, I can't do that, right? Like, I can't get the same voice, I can't get the same access to that.
No,
stuff.
Definitely not. Yeah.
And it's weird because you want open source to get money, but also, like, this is, I don't know, it's getting very complicated.
Yeah, if it's politics involved straight away, I think I preferred when I was very naive in the open source world before, like, realizing a lot of the things. But I do still think that the engineers themselves who do work, like, on Kubernetes or etcd or Prometheus and those kind of projects are truly, like, the nicest people. Like, it's been really interesting to, even if, like, they work for the corporations and everything, and the politics that happens there, it's not as visible, I would say, as one would think. I think they truly are really passionate about what they work on, like Kubernetes or the other projects. So,
well, and even just how intentional they were to set up the community up front. Like, we know we're part of a foundation, but, like, shout out to Sarah Novotny and Joe Beta and the people that were doing it early on and just saying, like, hey, we want this community to be very explicit about being welcoming. And if we have a problem here, like, we need to address that internally and look inward to do that.
The CNFC makes me want to play with Kubernetes just because I want to hang out with the people.
Like, yeah, it's been really nice. I go to KubeCons every once in a while. Not as much as I used to, but I still go. I was one, like, at the KubeCon EU, and I do, like, CFP reviews and things like that. But it's really nice to, like, just go there, and you still see the same people, like, who work on projects. Whether they're still at the same company, maybe not, but maybe they're a different company, but they still work on, like, on, I don't know, API server or whatever. And it's really nice.
And a lot of times they get that job because they did that work, right? They're like, oh, we have an initiative at this company to do more of that work, or we want to influence in a way. And they're hiring someone to also bring that influence in. And saying, like, oh, you're already a chair on this SIG. Please come help us out because we have changes we need to make. So, yeah.
Definitely.
Lily, thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can people find you online?
I have Twitter or whatever it's called these days. Still have that. So it's Lily Kosick or whatever I'm going to pronounce it. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on. Tell us all about Influx, what you've been doing, and kind of just your career and arc. This has been fascinating. So
your career is amazing. You just are so cool.
Thank you. I will now hide. Thanks for having me. It's been really fun talking to you.
It was so nice meeting you.
All right. We'll talk to you again soon.
3, 2, 1.
Thanks for listening to Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash. Subscribe now if you haven't already. Head to shipit.show for all the ways, or just search for Ship It wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find us. Thanks once again to our partners at fly.io, to the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder for these dope beats, and to Sentry. Use code CHANGELOG when you sign up and save $100 off their team plan. That's all for now, but come back next week when we continue discussing everything that happens after Git Push. Thank you.